Hello and welcome to the I Look Like a Doctor podcast, the podcast dedicated to interviewing physicians underrepresented in medicine to inspire the next generation. I am your host, Sarah Torres. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. So I actually recorded this episode back in March of 2022. Now, this was just before the mayhem of my match day. So obviously, in all of that frenzy of moving to Colorado, starting residency, you all know that I took some time away from podcasting. So I hadn't gotten around to editing this episode until now. So just for clarity, in this episode, I was a fourth-year medical student, and my good friend and guest, Dr. Rachel Conger, was an intern in her transitional year. Dr. Rachel Conger is now a PGY3 at the University of San Francisco Radiation Oncology Program. She was born and raised in La Crosse, Wisconsin. She attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison for undergrad and earned her bachelor's degree in history with honors. She earned her medical degree at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She identifies as a queer woman and is passionate about diversity, inclusion, and all things LGBTQ+. She is a fantastic home beer brewer and an unapologetic cat lady. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. And on today's episode, we have Dr. Conger. Dr. Conger, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
So typically how I'd like to start off the episode, I like to just kind of ask the guests to tell us a little bit about themselves, so their backstory, and then what drove them to medicine.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. Let's see. My mom growing up was a nurse. So that's kind of my first introduction to medicine. I grew up in a pretty rural part of Wisconsin. So I wasn't really exposed to like physicians very much outside of like the physicians that I went to as a child. But like I said, my mom was a nurse, and because it was such a rural area and the hospital that she worked at was so rural, it took like basically nothing for her to like introduce me to some of the physicians that she worked with. And then they were like, yeah, of course she can shadow me, because nothing else was happening at these little tiny community hospitals. So that is basically how I ended up in like getting interested in medicine. I knew I didn't want to be a nurse because my mom probably never should have been a nurse, given the rate at which she picked fights with physicians. So I think we like just both have a bit of a, you know, like a leadership mentality to us. So I knew that, you know, I wanted to be the one leading the team more so than just being on the team. So that's kind of how I decided to go the physician route as opposed to the nurse route. I did also think about being a PA also, but after talking to the PA that treated me when I was growing up, because she was like my main primary care provider, she was like, you should probably just be a doctor. She's like, it's all well and good to be a PA, but you'd probably get a lot more out of being a physician. So I went to undergrad at UW-Madison thinking that mm-hmm. I would go into medicine. Mm-hmm. But I also just like dabbled around a lot of other things. And so by the time I was graduating, I hadn't completed all of the prerequisites for med school because mm-hmm. I had spent a little too much time like thinking about being a theater major and then thinking about being a history PhD and then thinking about being a lawyer and then thinking about going into law enforcement and like just like too many random things. And then eventually I got to the point where I was like, yeah, I'm just gonna go to med school. But at that point I was like graduating. And I only had like one physics class left to take, but I hadn't like even considered like doing the MCAT or anything at that point. So I ended up taking 2 years off of school between undergrad and med school to do physics, take the MCAT, get some experience in healthcare, and then eventually applied from there.
Well, there's a lot of tidbits in there that I kind of want to go back and touch on. So the theater major, what swayed you away from that?
I have incredible stage fright. So yeah, that didn't work out for very long. Yeah. I took like one theater class and I was like, all right, never mind.
And then you ended up majoring, I think, in history, you said? Right. Okay. Okay. And so then you didn't do any of the prereqs during your actual like undergrad. You had to do it in the 2 additional years that you did afterwards, or is that?
I did all of the prereqs except 1 semester of physics during my undergrad course. Yes, because I was like the whole time I was like flirting with the idea of going to med school, because like every time I was like, oh, I won't do theater, I'll do medicine. And I was like, oh, I won't do medicine, I'll do history. Oh, I won't do history, I'll do medicine. Then so in the course of being in undergrad, I had completed all of the pre-med recs and was like, I was just kind of like doing it as a backup, which is great for me because it ended up being what I wanted to do. But
well, good for you, just because I know like a lot of people who are kind of dabbling along with like in their undergrad between medicine and something else, they usually like put off the pre-med courses until they actually decide they want to do it. So kudos to you for actually doing it both while you're in undergrad. Yeah, that sounds difficult.
Well, it was nice. I mean, it's nice to have the juxtaposition of history and science stuff.
Well, and I like that you brought that up, because I feel that a lot of our listeners always feel that they have to major in some sort of like science major, right? And that, you know, I think that with a lot of the guests that I've had on, we've kind of like disproven that. You know, I've had people that have been in public health, some that have been in the arts majors, and then now here, you, a history major. So it's definitely possible to do it all. And I think, like I said, you have actually that unique perspective that you were able to manage doing your history requirements along with your pre-med requirements. And then given that you are a first gen, essentially, how was that navigating that space for you? How did you know what to take and just like what you needed to do to become a doctor?
Yeah. Great question. Yeah, I definitely. So like my mom is a nurse, so she did have some college education, but this was like, she went to nursing school in like the 70s. So her college education was like a technical school to get her RN. She was not a BSN. She like didn't have the traditional like college experience that you would need to like help your kid go to college. Like applying to college and navigating college, applying to med school, navigating med school was like all a new thing for me. And so the nice thing is that at Madison, we had very good pre-health advising. Like there was like an entire pre-health advising. Like that was one of the type, like one of the columns of advising that you could go to. So I'm sure the other ones were like whatever science, and then another one was maybe like arts or whatever, but like pre-health had its own office basically, which was great because they just gave you a thing that was like, these are the things you need to do. And so me being the person that I am, all I needed was that checklist. And then I was like, all right, we're doing the checklist and we are doing our best to get decent grades. Because like coming from Bangor to Madison, you know, I could like sneeze and get an A in the like, you know, high school classes that I was taking because, you know, they weren't particularly difficult. And then like transitioning to UW-Madison, which is like a very academically rigorous, you know, I remember like transitioning to college, and when I was in high school, I was like, oh, I'm such a good writer. Like I've been, you know, writing history papers and English papers and getting such good grades on them, like writing so easy, blah, blah, blah. And then I did my placement test and they placed me in like English 100, which is like the first class. Like, it's basically like, you can't get any lower than English 100 if you speak English as a first language. So it was like, Jesus.
Hello, wake up call for me.
Yeah, it was a huge wake up call to transition to Madison. And then, yeah, like have to start from the bottom. I think like a big part of my transition to college was realizing that like I had to work a lot harder than I was in high school to like do well in my classes. So like, yeah, I think in terms of like figuring out how to get into med school, it was really like meeting with the pre-health advisors, getting that checklist, and then like just hustling in class to like get something that was a B or better, because otherwise it was like, this is never going to happen for me. And then like, you know, they, even on that checklist, you know, they would have like, oh, you should like try to volunteer and you should, like get some experience in healthcare in some way, shape or form that you can talk about. So, I ended up like volunteering at the hospital, in Madison with the therapy dogs, which was so nice because it was good for me and it was good for the patients. So yeah, I mean, I guess really it just came down to like having advisors at school that were like actually invested in us, and which was also a new thing for me because my guidance counselor in high school was terrible. So it was like nice to have that guidance and like feel like I could email back and forth. I mean, I had, I emailed my personal statement to them even after I graduated and I had taken that time off. Like they were still like, as an alumni, they were still like allowing me to communicate with them and like continue to get advisory from them, which was really nice.
That's awesome. And I love that you share that utilizing that health professions office or that pre-health advising office is a really big key. Did you end up getting mentorship from like anywhere else, like any student organizations or just anybody that you met through your experiences?
No, I ended up not having like any like true mentorship from like a physician and I never joined any of the like the pre-health groups at Madison. Partially because like, I don't know if you've met pre-meds, but they are a terrible breed of human. I was always like, man, that is toxic. I cannot be a part of that cult. Like I can't, like, it was just too high strung for me, like too stressful. Something that I like learned about myself. I think I probably knew it then, but like really figured it out more so in med school that like, if I put myself around high stress people, I will be a high stress person. But if I bring myself down and hang out with people who are just normal and like want to also enjoy life in addition to going to med school, you know, I can become like a much more reasonable human being and like have a much nicer go of things. So I really like separated myself out from pre-med people, which probably was a little bit disadvantageous because the crazy pre-med people really know what you need to be doing. And so they will be like, oh my God, have you done this yet? And you're like, I haven't done it yet. And so like, it's great because you're like, oh God, this needs to be added to my checklist. But at the same time, you're like, oh my God, like I haven't been doing this for 2 years and they have, what am I going to do? So I separated myself out from pre-med people. I had like a couple people who I was close with that were wanting to do medicine. And so we kind of were our own little like normal pre-med cohort. And so I kind of kept up with them in terms of that. But like otherwise, no, I didn't have any like formal mentorship at all. I didn't know like any physicians. I shadowed in the ED after like going through the process of like filling out like the formal shadowing stuff like through the pre-health organization or through the pre-health office, but like at no point did I like have a real connection with a physician or anybody else that I knew that was in med school or anything. So I really was like the blind leading the blind.
Dr. Conger, that sounds like such a lonely journey.
Yeah, I mean, no, it was definitely like
right, but the blind leading crazy. The blind, right? Like you only know what they know, and
right. Yeah, it's like a miracle we ended up here.
Well, on that, did you find any difficulties in applying, like during the application process to medical school? Did you apply broadly? Did you only apply to the Midwest? How did that go for you?
I applied broadly in the sense that, like, I applied to basically all the like reasonably well-known med schools in the country, which was like probably not what I should have done. I should have applied to like things that were like schools that were in like a slightly lower tier than what I was shooting for. I think it would have given me a lot more opportunity to explore other places. But yeah, so I obviously did not get invited to interview many places because I was just shooting a little too high. So yeah, I was very discouraged during it. I did get in my first round, which was like nice. And I definitely decided I didn't want to do a second round. So I just like took the one acceptance that I got and just like went for it and was like, whatever, I'm just gonna do this and, you know, not worry about it. But I would say like from an application standpoint, yeah, I mean, I didn't know like how to finesse, you know, my personal statement to be something special. I didn't know how to like write about my activities to make it so obvious that I would make an excellent physician. Like, I didn't know about like interview communication, like if I should send an email to say that I was really interested, like I got waitlisted at a couple places, and I was like, I don't know how to tell them that I would like this opportunity, blah, blah, blah. And so, I mean, like, definitely applying was like still the blind leading the blind. It was just like, well, I mean, I guess I'm doing all the things that I know to do. But at the same time, like, I feel like a lot of people who apply to med school, especially if they have like good mentorship in place, have like kind of that like inside scoop about like, you know, what to do, when, where, why, how kind of thing. It's just like, you know, that like secret messaging that just gets passed down from person to person. And like, you know, now I feel like I have some of that, and I like love to dish it out to, you know, people who are in the same process that I was. But yeah, at the time it was definitely like, I just felt like I was checking boxes and didn't know like why. And I also didn't know how to like make those boxes work for me. It was just like, oh, this is a box. I better check it because they're looking for me to check boxes. But without like having the understanding that like, okay, I checked this research box, but now I'm going to show up to this interview and talk about this research that I did for a year and a half, which I really didn't understand, also didn't really like, but just did it because I was told by a pre-health advising office that I should do research. And so then when I showed up to my interviews, they were like, well, she obviously hates this. I think, you know, like I didn't get that like little nugget of information that like, oh, you can do research in anything. It doesn't have to be in medicine. They just want you to show that you understand the scientific process. And then if you enjoy what you're doing research in, you'll show up to your interviews and talk about it with like, you know, a sparkle in your eye instead of deadness in your eyes.
Yeah, like I think that that's a really good point that you bring up, because there are so many ways to become a doctor, and you don't necessarily always, well, that advice did work for you and everything. Like, I think it is always better to apply with experiences that you're super passionate about. So do you have any advice for our pre-meds listening now? Like what kind of experiences they should go for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so for example, my volunteerism that I did with the therapy dogs, I was like over the moon about. I absolutely loved it. It gave me a great opportunity to interact with patients. We like just went to two floors in the hospital, like a rehab floor and then a psych unit. And it was a great time. And because I enjoyed what I was doing, when I went on interviews to talk about it, like the interviewers could tell that like it was something I was passionate about. I like obviously gained a lot of like just experience from it, but like without it being a thing that I did just for the experience, you know, I did it also because I enjoyed it. And I think that's like a key thing for two reasons. Number one, it like demonstrates to your interviewers who are judging whether or not you should be accepted to a medical school, that like, you know, your care, your interest, your passion for medicine like comes organically. It's not just like a thing that you're doing because you're checking these boxes so that way later in life you can check other boxes kind of thing. And then the other part of it is that like I actually like loved this experience. Like, you know, down the road if I get a dog, I'd love to have that dog be a therapy dog. And you know, it was like a really great way for me to like get exposed to the patient experience. And so I like my big piece of advice that I tend to give like all pre-meds and med students is like, yes, check the boxes, because you have to check the boxes, but find a way to check those boxes that like is enjoyable to you. So you know, if you are, you know, required to do research to demonstrate that you can do research, because that's important for our field, then you find a research project that you care about, that you, you know, like now that I have figured that much out, I like to do research in like health equity spaces, especially to for like LGBTQ research, because that is something I care about. It's something I'm passionate about. It's not inside of a lab with a pipette. Like that is not research that I care about. So like having this opportunity to like, you know, be engaged in these spaces with the patient population that I care about makes a huge difference in how I look at research now. Because before I was like, man, this is dumb. it sucks. I don't want to do any of this. Like, I'm just wasting mm-hmm. my time. I actually don't understand what this project is about. But when you are picking the project and you are gearing it towards a thing that you care about, you're like, oh, like, I know what we're doing. I know why we're doing it. And I care that we are doing it. So like, that's, yeah, definitely my biggest piece of advice is like, check the boxes, but do it in a way that makes you happy. Because otherwise, like, it's no fun.
That's very well said. And I actually also wanted to circle back. You mentioned not knowing to send like those letters of intent to schools that maybe you were interested in. And I forgot there was something else that you had mentioned, but along those lines, like what kind of advice now would you give to pre-meds in those, you know, similar circumstances where maybe they're waiting for a response from the school that they really want and sending like maybe like update letters and things like that?
Yeah. So I ended up sending a letter of intent. So once I got waitlisted at the one school that I was really interested in, I ended up sending a letter of intent. And I would encourage anybody to send a letter of intent. It hurts you, but not at all.
What is that for our listeners who don't know?
Yeah, for sure. So a letter of intent is a like pretty short, concise, basically love letter to whatever program that you are interested in. It demonstrates to them that like you showed up on interview day, you listened to all the things that they said about their program. You've picked out specific things about their program that like really drew you in and is going to like make you a successful student at their program. So for example, the program that I was interested in was just transitioning to a flipped classroom style, which I was into because I, you know, am not necessarily like a lecture style person. I like to do more like hands-on and like critical thinking based learning. It helps me remember things better. And so they were like just about to switch to that. And I was like, ooh, this is perfect for me. And then they also happened to have like 16 free clinics that they sent students to in the community. And I was like, this is crazy and super cool. And like one of them was specifically like an LGBTQ free clinic. So I was like, these are all the things that I like really care about your program. And I would like love to be able to, you know, be a part of it. Unfortunately, this one year was like a bizarre year and they didn't have any movement on their wait list at all. Like not a single person came off their wait list. But yeah, so the idea behind a letter of intent is that you just send it, you say, hey, I would love to come to your program. So that way they know that if they bring you in, it's an automatic acceptance for them. And you like have a true passion for like their program specifically. You're not just saying like, hey, I want to get into any med school ever.
So we can't send letter of intents to like all the programs, right?
Right. It would be a terrible idea because programs do communicate with each other. So if you're going to send her a letter of intent, send it to just one school and call it day.
That's really sound advice. Okay. And so now moving forward, we're in medical school now. What was the hardest part for you?
Yeah, this is a good question. So I think the hardest part for med school for me was like the time between starting to study for step two and then transitioning into third year. And it was hard for a lot of reasons. I mean, don't get me wrong. The first 2 years of med school, especially if you go to a very classically styled med school where it's like the first 2 years are preclinical and the second 2 years are clinical. The first 2 years, you're like, wow, I am just learning out of books and like my self-worth is measured by exam scores. And that is certainly not ideal. That being said, you can adjust to it. So like, you know, the first little bit, you're like, oof, this is really hard. And yeah, it definitely isn't pleasant. But eventually you just like get used to it and you're like, well, this is my life. So then I think what happened from like the second part of the second year into the first part of the third year is I was like, all right, well, this is my life. And it wasn't pretty, you know, your life is literally just studying for 8 to 12 hours a day and then taking an exam. And that's it. That's your life. You're not really interacting with patients. When you are, it's like with a apprenticeship mentor who is very nice, but at the same time, you're like, this person's judging how I'm talking to another human being. Like, this is not reasonable. And then you start studying for step two, which is very isolating. or step one, mm-hmm. because you mm-hmm. are just sitting alone in your home. Like you friends are, you're talking to your friends, but not really. Cause like, you know, you can't be like, my friends can't know how dumb I am. So you're just like sitting in your house alone for, I think I studied for 5 dedicated weeks plus like 4 weeks of like the last class that we were taking in school. So it was like almost 9 weeks of just like sitting at this desk, like mm-hmm. taking UWorld block after UWorld block. And just like my whole self-worth was based on like the 4 blocks of UWorld I did a day. Mm-hmm. And it was horrible. And then you finally finish step one and you go on a little vacation or whatever. And then you come back into third year, which is a totally different way to measure your self-worth, because like mm-hmm. you're showing up and you're having to do things that you have no idea how to do. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, knowing the whole time that while you're doing those things, you're being like just meticulously judged. Mm-hmm. And so I really like made this transition, and I was like, for a moment, I was like, oh my God, like this is why I want to go to med school. Because I think towards the end of second year, I was having very serious thoughts about like, I mean, I knew I couldn't stop med school because I was too far in debt and like, you know, mm-hmm. I was too committed. but like, I was having really very serious thoughts about like what a huge mistake I had made going to med school. Cause I was like, I am like, not, this is not what I want to be doing. I'm not happy. And then I transitioned mm-hmm. to third year and I was like, oh yes. Okay. Patience. Like, you know, and I started on peds, which is a great rotation to start on because all the residents and physicians are very nice. Mm-hmm. And you're interacting with cute little kids, and like, sure, their parents are crazy, but they're just worried about their kids. And they're like, just grateful that you came into the room to talk to them. And so you're having all these like wonderful experiences where your heart is like warming back up from its cold, mm-hmm. dead, icy state. And so you are like starting to have this like breath of fresh air and remembering why you went to med school and why you want to be a physician. And that's great. But then the second you start to hit a groove, you transition into a new rotation. And now mm-hmm. Everything's out the window. You have to start again. And you're back in this place where you're like, I don't know anything. Everybody's judging me for how much I don't know, blah, blah, blah. And mm-hmm. it was just like, really, I was really starting to take a toll on me. So about halfway through third year, I ended up starting antidepressants because I was just like so constantly so anxious. Just going into every day of clinicals, like thinking like, you know, what am I going to do wrong today? Or like, and this is coming from someone who, you know, did very well in clinicals. I did very well in clinicals, and yet I was like barely able to sleep every night, like knowing how anxious I was to go get up in the morning, go see my patients and have to present on them, and like having these like mm-hmm. huge fears and anxieties around presenting on patients and in front of this team of people who's, you know, bigger, better, smarter than me, whatever. And I just like, you know, I really couldn't take it. I was so unhappy. That was, I think, those like maybe 8 months was just like too bogged down in all of the difficulty of mm-hmm. being isolated and then being out in the, like too out in the open. And then like having to make these transitions from rotation to rotation, like just constantly feeling mm-hmm. like I wasn't good enough and I wasn't doing enough. I think that was definitely hardest, but then I did start antidepressants, which really dropped my anxiety down from like, I couldn't hear myself think to like a dull roar, which was great because then like, mm-hmm. it really like smoothed things out. And I could like, mm-hmm. I could say to myself, yeah, this thing is making me anxious, but like, that's okay. And I'm just going to move on, instead mm-hmm. of like just dwelling on that thing and letting it be like a very intense, like cycle of just like dread, basically. Mm-hmm. So yeah, then transitioning from there, you know, I like finished out the rest of third year, which was hit by COVID. Mm-hmm. But other than that, like it definitely basically like at that point, like halfway through third year, I started to realize that like, okay, these people who I think are judging me every second of every minute of every day are actually just people who have their own stuff going on, especially now that I'm an intern and I can like look back and now I've got my own med students and I'm like, yeah, obviously I care about my med students. I want them to succeed. I want them to learn. But at the same time, like, I don't care. I got to do my own thing. Like, I got to write my own notes. I got to do my own presentation still. Like, I still have to prove to other people that I'm not dumb. So like, yes, it's so stressful to be a med student. But I think a big piece of advice to med students is like, just remember that the people on rotations with you are also people and like have their own things to worry about. And they really are not thinking about you every second of every day. Maybe that's like just my own ego showing, but it was stressful. And then the other thing that like I really came to terms with was I'm here to learn. I'm not here to be perfect. That's not the idea. And so, you know, if someone's going to ding me for like not knowing this answer to this like step-based question on rounds while they're pimping me, like that's on them. Like that's not what I'm here for. I'm here to like get this experience and like be like trained to be a better physician. So I think like those two things like really helped me to just calm down, relax, like enjoy my rotations, get what I could out of them. And then like, yeah, transition to the next one and say to myself, yeah, it's my first day on this rotation. I'm not going to know what I'm doing. They know that. I know that. Let's move on.
Thank you for being so transparent with us. And I mean, all of what you said is very insightful. And I think a lot of med students are going to be able to relate to feeling all that anxiety every time that they start a new rotation. I know I certainly felt that way, that I am being judged every second of the day. And I'm not yet a resident, but I came to find out that they are not paying as close attention to me as I think they are. Although, yes, they do want me to succeed and they do want me to do what I'm there for. And then also with what you were saying about the anxiety of presenting, I totally related to that. Like I felt so much anxiety and it kind of reminded me too of what you said earlier about maybe it's like a component of the stage fright, which I don't know if it's that or if it's just definitely like the anxiety of feeling that what you're saying is going to be, you know, maybe it's not as medical sounding as, you know, you want it to be. And that's where I had my anxiety. And I think it's great that you shared that because a lot of med students, I think, are going to find that really relatable.
Yeah. Yeah. Presenting is definitely, I think, the hardest. I mean, I think it's always like the biggest, most frightening thing about starting rotations is you're like, oh, God, they like expect me to like know what's relevant and what's pertinent. And they want me to say it in a way that makes sense. And I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just showing up here. I don't know. So you're like, do they want me to read the whole BMB or do they even care what this patient's sodium is? And yeah, you just have to learn by doing. And a couple times you're going to have an attending who says, hey, please stop reading all the labs to me. And like, that's okay. Because the next attending you have is going to say, I would like every single lab. And you got to roll with it. And you got to remember that they're people too, and they just want what they want.
No, and that's a very good point. You are never going to please everyone. So even if you find your groove and your certain presentation style, too bad, you're going to have to change it probably with the next attending, and that's fine. So next question, when did you decide that you wanted to do radiation oncology?
Yes, I had, I think, what is a pretty standard come to Jesus moment with radiation oncology. So there's like basically two buckets of people who go into radiation oncology. There's people who somehow knew about it before they even came to med school. Those are very special people. I don't know where they come from. But they know it before they get here and they just like are gung-ho from day one that they want to go into rad onc. And then there's everyone else who like stumbles into it in the dark blindly, just like falls flat on their face in radiation oncology for some reason. And then they love it. And so I was, of course, the second one. So I had a mentor in school who was a radiation oncologist and met her through like some of the diversity and inclusion things on campus. And at one of those events, she was like just talking about radiation oncology. And I was like, I don't know if this is for me, but it sounds kind of interesting. And also she's one of the deans. And I think it'd be cool if she wrote my dean's letter and knew me a little bit better. So I'm just going to rotate with her and see what happens. So I really ended up picking a radiation oncology elective, just so that way I could spend more time with this particular mentor. And I had also heard it was a really easy rotation. So I was like, sounds good. This is what I need. So yeah, went into it without any expectation. At that point, I had loved my peds rotation. So I was going to be a pediatrician at that point. Which is very funny because I absolutely hate inpatient medicine at this point. Anyway, so I finished out my first week of RADONC with the program director. He was my attending for the week. And I just sat him down at the end of the week and I said, like, what do I need to know to get into this specialty? Because I think I like it. Which was terrifying at the time because radiation has been known to be a more competitive specialty. And like I said, I was planning to be a pediatrician, which is known to be a less competitive specialty. So I was like, I'm just going to take my step score, pack up my little bags, and go be a pediatrician. It's going to be a breeze. I can't wait. And then I stumbled into RADONC and I was like, no, I can't do this. Like, I'm going to have to start trying again. And I didn't want to do that. I did not want to try anymore. I was sick of trying. We already talked about this. So yeah, I like sat him down. I was like, all right, what do I like actually have to do to get into this specialty and like what's going on? And he was like, well, you know, you need to have a pretty decent step score. And you need to have done some research.
And what's a pretty decent step score for the specialty?
God, what was the, I think the average was like 240, for RADONC at that point. Yeah. Something around 240, I think was the average step score. That being said, RADONC, I will just like give the dish on RADONC real quick, just that way everybody, has an idea of what's going on with the field right now. So RADONC used to be really crazy competitive, average step score was a 240. Like people were taking research years. Like it was very competitive to get into. And then over the past, I think 5 or 6 years, there's been a huge decline, in applications to RADONC. A lot of this has to do with, a lot of fear surrounding the job market in radiation oncology. Which is like a weird thing to have to think about as a medical student. Cause you're like, what happened to like doing what I love? You know, I'm supposed to like worry about the job market now. So yeah, I remember one of the first times ever telling another resident in another specialty that I wanted to go into RADONC. And the first thing out of his mouth was, oh, shame, there's no jobs in that. He was like in anesthesia. And I was like, what are you even talking about, sir? I was like, okay, don't be happy for me. That's fine. So yeah, it's this like well-known, well-publicized thing that there's no jobs in RADONC. And so because of that, there's been a huge decline in applications. So when I applied, there are about 200 spots nationwide for RADONC. When I applied, I think there were only like 160 applicants initially. Obviously, like after the first, like after applications closed and more people applied. So like after applications closed, there were about 160 applicants. And then after that, it filled up to around like 190 or so was how many applicants filled up. And then now RADONC programs who used to be crazy competitive, now soaping to fill their spots. So like it's been a huge transition in the field in terms of applications. And so what I tend to say about my application cycle is that I was definitely part of a buyer's market. And I didn't know this going in. So I was still like very fearful, had a lot of anxiety about picking RADONC. But that being said, yeah, my experience applying to RADONC is very different from someone from like 10 years ago, if you ask them. So yeah, that's certainly something.
And the specialty is like a predominantly like white male kind of dominated field, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So then was that also another source of anxiety for you, being a like queer woman trying to get into the space?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, there were like a handful of things. I was like, this is too competitive for me to get into. And also, like, doesn't fit my personality. Those were like my two big things that I really tried to talk myself out of radiation oncology, because I was like, I don't want to do this much work. And I don't know that these are my people. I sat down with the program director. He's have a good step sort, do research. And at that point, the research that I had done was like for my school required scholarly project, which was about prison healthcare, basically, not related to radiation at all. Little did I know at that time that because the field and the application field was the way it was, nobody cared what I did research in. And I think this might be like, that could have maybe always been true, especially for like the top programs. For my cycle, they didn't care what I did research in. They just wanted to see that I could do research, again, checking these boxes. But this time I checked the boxes in a way that made me happy. And so, when I sat down and heard like I needed to do research, I was like, damn, I do not want to do this. I mean, I will say like my home radiation oncology program made me feel like a little less concerned about going into the field, because it's like one of the few programs in the country that is like dominated by women. It's over 50% women, which is bananas. Like, that's almost unheard of in RadOnc, for a RadOnc department. So I was like, that was like nice. I was like, okay, like maybe this is doable. But definitely, I think like, sure, there were women, but like most of them were white, most of them were straight. Like, it was just like, you know, like the dress code was like super severe. When I like the dress code that they sent to the med students for this rotation was like, men will wear button-up shirts, ties, and slacks, and then like women will wear dresses, skirts, or slacks with appropriate hosiery, blah blah. And I was like, what in the world is going on here? It had been updated for like a century.
It sounds like
I just remember being like, ugh, I don't like this. And then there was like one particular attending too, who is like very well known for like thinking that, you know, women should like not have their legs exposed. And so like, I remember being pulled aside by one of the residents. I was wearing pants that went all the way down to my ankles, but like, you know, the space between my ankle and my foot was exposed, my shoe. And she was like, just so you know, this attending is going to say something to you if she sees that your ankles are exposed. And I was like, so
what?
I was just like, man, I have just like stepped back into the 1950s trying to be a radiation oncologist. I was really very concerned that I was like not going to be happy, because I had just decided I wanted to be a pediatrician, where all the people are happy and fun and like just nobody cares about anything. They're just there to like take care of cute little kids. And then transitioning to this like very like rigid box type space that I was like, oof, I don't know. So in order to counteract that, I ended up, so there's a, ACRO is the resident association for RadOnc. And I ended up signing up for a mentor through ACRO. And I specifically said, like, I'd like an LGBTQ mentor, if such a thing exists. but that being said, one of the residents at my home program when I was rotating was a gay man. So I was like, oh, there's hope. Okay, it's going to be like, there's at least one other. I reached out. I ended up getting a mentor in the field who was LGBTQ. We had like a cute little Zoom meeting, and he just like started listing off other people in the field who identify, and like got me in contact with a couple of the more prominent gay women in the field too, who were very happy to like talk to me about their experience in the field also. All that stuff was very reassuring. And like, I just, you know, said to myself, well, like, you know, I've never really been one, I guess, to like make sure that I fit into, like, sure, I'm going to check the boxes, but who says I'm going to fit inside of them? I just thought, like, you know, one way or another, I'll find a way to like fit into whatever program I am in, that like, I will just change the shape of the program if I really need to like make this work for me. Really, like, I mean, ahead of time, I like got advice from other LGBTQ people in the field, like, yeah, wouldn't go to this program because of, you know, whatever reason. And so like, I definitely like use my resources, but then also after, you know, specifically not applying to some programs, like some in the Deep South or whatever, I was just like transitioning from that and then like actually interviewing, you could like get a sense for when a program was like truly, had like good allyship or whatever. So,
Yeah, you know, I love that you'll check all the boxes, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to fit inside them. That's going to be the quote I think I'm going to use for when I promote this. You have to find where you fit in, right? Because it's a long way, right? Is your program 4 years training, I think, right? Yeah. And so it's a very long time for you to feel that you don't belong somewhere. And I guess not even beyond the program, if you feel like the specialty, even though you really like it, if you feel you're not going to belong there in the long term, sure, you can change it from within while you're there, but it's going to take a while, right? And so I really love that you were able to find allies and connect with them. And it made me really happy to see that this is kind of like the complete opposite of when you applied to medical school, right? Like you, the blind lead the blind, just kind of trying to get in. And then here on the other side now with residency applications, you definitely made use of your resources and talked to people.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I definitely learned from my, I mean, I wouldn't say mistakes because I didn't really know any better, but I definitely learned from my like med school application experience that like, this is not how you do it. And I will say like, yeah, I think it's easier to get more help in med school because med schools tend to be smaller spaces than, I mean, UW-Madison has 40,000 students on campus. So it's easy to kind of get lost. But like, yeah, I mean, I rotated through a department with two residents in each class and, you know, a program director and an associate program director. So it didn't take much for me to like sit down with several people and just say, hey, like, what do I need to know? How do I get there? You know, how much help can you give me? And that's, yeah, that's the other thing is how much help can you give me? I mean, my home program was so supportive of me. I had multiple people like email on my behalf to different programs. You know, everybody was more than happy to write a letter of recommendation for me. And then, yeah, once I got to the point where I was like, all right, like, what do I need to know about different programs? Like, my program director sat down with me and went through every single program with me and gave me his opinion on it. And then the LGBTQ people that I'd reached out to in the field, both like attendings and residents, gave me their opinions on like LGBTQ friendly programs. So yeah, I mean, I did the exact opposite of my medical school application experience for residency applications. I was like, I will take every person's advice I can get and I will like specifically go after it. Like, I'm not going to like wait around and like wait for someone to stumble in my lap to help me. Like, I'm just going to go harass everyone I know until like I have every piece of information I need.
Always professionally, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But I also love that you shared that tip too, that you can get a mentor through the association, right? Like I wouldn't have known that. So I think that's really helpful for any medical students looking to get into the field. And then also just you kind of busting up those myths that kind of revolve around this field. I think it kind of gives medical students who are considering the specialty hope that, you know, it's not as, maybe, I mean, I think it still is a competitive field, but it's not as daunting as it might have seemed before.
Yeah. I would say if anybody wants to apply to RADONC, now is the time. It's like the least applied to specialty. Like if you look at any of the Brian Carmody, Dr. Carmody's stats on his website, I mean, RADONC is like went from being most competitive to least competitive. Like, it's crazy. It's so insane. Definitely is a great time to get into the field. And I guess like just to kind of clarify in regards to like the job market situation that everybody's up in arms about, they've kind of made a transition of training more radiation oncologists than we necessarily need in like LA, for example. But, you know, if you are, like myself, a country bumpkin, and there are a myriad of situations you'd be happy to live in, you're going to find a job. Like, I mean, if someone said to me, like, there is a job in, you know, like suburban Illinois or whatever, I'd be like, cool, it's close to Chicago. Like, I mean, I grew up in the middle of nowhere. Like, it's fine. I'll get a job somewhere. It'll be fine. Like, it's just like, yeah, you want to be at like the top academic institution in Chicago making $700,000 and working 4 days a week. Like, yeah, that job doesn't exist. Sorry about that. Maybe it did 20 years ago, but it doesn't anymore. And like, sure, we all have to come to terms with that. That's very sad. But like, radiation is an extremely well-compensated field. You're not going to be overworked as a radiation oncologist. It's all clinic hours. There's very little mm-hmm. call, especially if you work at an academic institution. And like, it's a wonderful field that you get a lot of joy out of. So, you know, if that joy comes from treating folks who, you know, are suburban or maybe like even a little bit more rural in terms of like, you know, maybe more of like a farming population or whatever that may be, like mm-hmm. you are still seeing people through a cancer diagnosis, which is ultimately mm-hmm. why, you know, folks get into this field. So I think, sure, the job market isn't what it used to be, but it certainly isn't like a reason not to get into radiation oncology.
Mm. No, thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, it seems like it's just basically if you're not willing to compromise as to where you get that job, then sure, it's going to be a little bit limited for you. But I think if anyone has learned anything from this journey, you have to apply broadly and be willing to compromise a little. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like, absolutely.
Okay. And so being the country bumpkin that you are, how are you feeling about being a Midwest gal moving over to San Francisco for the University of San Francisco?
Yeah. I'm very excited. So the most urban I've ever lived before Milwaukee was Berlin, which is like 3.5 million people or something. And I only lived there for mm-hmm. 3 months, but I loved it. And mm-hmm. so I have a feeling I'm going to adjust pretty well to San Francisco. I only ever used public transportation when I was in Berlin too. So I think the fact that like most people still bring a car to SF is like even a bonus on top of that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's going to be a transition for sure. But I just am really excited to be in a large city, especially a large city with such a rich cultural LGBTQ history. I think that's mm-hmm. like really mm-hmm. just going to be the cherry on top of this all. Because, yeah, I mean, I just have always been so like connected to that part of myself ever since coming mm-hmm. out, and I'm really excited to like really be fully immersed in that. And then like I think knowing that I'm going to be in SF and at UCSF, like really, like I'm just so excited for what the like culture is going to be like, because I think it has so mm-hmm. much potential to be exactly what I will fit into, and like just fun mm-hmm. and diverse and exciting. And yeah, definitely there won't be dress codes based on gender, so that'll be great.
Yes. Oh, I'm very excited for you. And I think I should clarify too that you're currently an intern doing your transitional year in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So then is it a total of 5 years then for the whole residency, correct?
Yeah.
So I just wanted our listeners to be clear on, you know, it's the 4 years of residency for radiation oncology plus a 1 year transitional year for your intern year.
But if I have anything to say about it in my career, it will just be 4 years of radiation oncology residency.
What do you mean?
I mean, like, I think I'm going to lobby for this whole transitional year to be changed, because I can see the educational purpose of it, don't get me wrong, but mm-hmm. you know, like transitional years are in fact being transitioned out of a lot of specialties that used to require them, like pathology mm-hmm. for example used to require a transitional year. It doesn't anymore. When radiation mm-hmm. oncology first became its own specialty, they actually encouraged residents to do a surgical prelim, so that way they could have that experience going into their radiation oncology, and so like that's not a recommended thing anymore. So I feel like, you know, we're on our way out of expecting that like folks who are going into hyper specialized fields have to have this like well-rounded experience, because like what was med school then? Like, why did I go mm-hmm. to med school? And so,
or at the very least, like I think because then you would have to do like all of the rotations that are very like general medicine, right? Like, you're not, it's not even like you're doing rotations that are like special, like a little bit more specific, like towards your field, right?
Right. Yeah. So there's only like one or two, maybe three or four RADA programs that are categorical. Most anesthesia programs nowadays are categorical. So if you match into an anesthesia program at one program, you are automatically matched into their intern year as well. So those two things are like put together. Advanced match, which is what most RADONC programs are, is that you match separately into your intern year. So I had to fill out like a supplemental rank list. So for each RADONC program that I ranked, I also had to rank a supplemental rank list with the intern year that I wanted to complete for that program. Because I did med school in Milwaukee, wanted to do my transitional year in Milwaukee, I just had one supplemental rank list because I just wanted to stay here, as opposed to like, if I had ranked UCSF, I could have then had a supplemental rank list where I applied and ranked transitional years or prelim years in San Francisco. But I decided I did not want to pay San Francisco rent for an extra year, and I would rather just stay in my Hilo apartment in Milwaukee for another year. But yeah,
so, can I have you like clarify that a little bit? Because I'm a little bit confused. So then is it one supplemental rank list, or is it one per?
You can make as many supplemental rank lists as you want.
Oh,
so I think most people would do a supplemental per city. So like if you were to apply to like multiple programs in Chicago, for example, for each Chicago RADONC program, you'd have a like Chicago rank list for your preliminary year or for your intern year. But since my top three TY programs, the first two were in Milwaukee and the third one was in La Crosse, Wisconsin. So, yeah, I didn't want to move.
Gotcha. Okay. So that makes more sense.
Yeah. So I think if they were to like make a transition to categorical for RADONC, where like, I think it would be totally reasonable to have RADONCs do an intern year that is geared towards cancer. I think that'd be great. Sloan Kettering does a transitional year that is like basically all like cancer focused. But yeah, I think that'd be a lot more appropriate than like having me be an intern on wards for 5 months.
Yeah.
And then like doing random electives here and there where I'm like basically a glorified med student. But
No, and that makes sense. I know that like how you said the inpatient stuff, everything that you're learning in intern year, it does have its educational value, of course, but in the grand scheme of things, you're going to be a radiation oncologist. I think having a transitional year more tailored to rotations that are going to be more beneficial to you would make sense.
Any luck.
I wish you luck with that. Yeah. Well, okay. So we're nearing the end of our session here, and I want to be respectful of your time. So I usually like to end the podcast with just having a little, a little bit of time for you to share any last words of wisdom or any last advice that you have for our listeners.
Yeah. Well, I think, like I said, my biggest piece of advice for anybody making the transition from college to med school or med school to residency is that however you spend your time, make sure that it is something that you care about and something that you enjoy doing, because it's going to make you stand out that much more on interviews when you talk about those things and demonstrate your just overall, because I think that the passion that you can demonstrate for a quote unquote extracurricular activity naturally translates into passion for medicine, passion for your specialty, your field, whatever it may be. So that is certainly my biggest piece of advice. And we've already touched on that. But the other thing that I think is important and something that especially like helped me get through med school and I'm sure will help me get through residency is that in the end, you know, this is a career, this is a job. Like, it's very important that you have things that you care about outside of medicine. For me, that was like mostly spending time with my friends, but it meant like hanging up my like med school stuff and like really focusing on having a good time away from like school stuff. It's very hard. It's very anxiety provoking to say like, all right, I'm going to leave the studying for tomorrow because you know, then your mind starts to lose it. For me, I definitely think it kept me sane to like, say tonight, I'm just going to go out and have dinner and drinks with my friends. We're going to have a good time and I'll come back to it tomorrow. Or, you know, I am going to pick up this homebrewing hobby, and spend, you know, 3 or 4 hours on it every few weeks because it brings me joy. And, you know, I do it with my friend and we have a great time while we do it. And then there's beer to drink when it's over. And so like, just remember that, like, in the end, you are going to become a physician. And as a physician, that's your career. That's your job. You're going to come home to whatever version of family you have, whatever version of a home you have, whatever, you know, you like to do outside of work. That is how your life is going to be, just like any other adult human with a job. And so I think it's important to like keep that in mind while you're in med school, because like you just can't let it take over your whole life. Otherwise you are going to be pretty unhappy. I do like concede that it's very different from a job, because you can't just shut med school off. You know, you don't just like go home at the end of the day, probably because you're already home studying. But yeah, I think it's just like important to kind of basically like treat med school like you know, would a career otherwise, and just say like, yeah, this is one part of me, but then the other part of me is my family and my friends and the things I like to do outside of it. And, you know, I'm not going to be the person who's like, yes, and go exercise, because I never exercised. But there are other ways to, you know, keep yourself healthy outside of med school and outside of studying. And I would just, yeah, say, don't forget to keep those things handy. So that way you can just live your life, especially for those of us who, you know, like went to med school as like 26-year-olds or whatever. and like, you know, already like have a semblance of what life looks like outside of school.
No, that's all very well said. Take care of yourself. It's a long journey. And don't forget, you know, to do that. I love that. So with that, we'll go ahead and end this episode here. Thank you so much, Dr. Conger, for joining us today.
So happy to be here, Sarah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the I Look Like a Doctor podcast. If you would be so kind as to leave us a review on your listening platform, it would really help us to get the show out to more people. Thank you.